Good morning. So good to be with you guys. Such a joy for me to preach and teach and talk about really weird Old Testament passages. Hopefully you'll be into it with me. If we haven't met, I'm Kendra. I'm an Old Testament theologian and teacher. So my niche weirdness is I love the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So the weirder, the better for me. And so I want to talk about that and hopefully open up some space for hope and mystery for us, and even some practice, which might seem crazy that ancient people could tell us how to practice our faith today, but we're gonna shoot for it, so let's try it. My favorite psalm, one of them, is Psalm 74, and I think when you heard it today, maybe, and maybe when I talk about it, you'll find some things in common with this writer of the ancient text. This is a lament. It's in particular, it's a communal lament. So that's a song meant to be sung by a community. They were writing of a people of old who were in the midst of utter chaos, loss, and confusion. The title in a lot of translations says, "A Plea for Help in Time of National Humiliation." So maybe you already found yourself in the text. I don't have to say anything else. Is it possible you're like, wow, that's me in an ancient text right there? Again, this song is actually a lament, a communal lament. If you're unfamiliar with that word, it's a genre of song, a type of song. And the lament is when the people of God are experiencing disorientation. So at some point, they had like a base or a system of thinking, living, worshiping, practicing faith that for all intents and purposes made sense. It worked. Old Testament theologian Walter Brueggemann named this cycle, and he said that was called orientation, but now something terrible, wild, agonizing has happened, and the people, the author, the community, are holding on to two realities, and that's very painful. They first believed God was good, or perhaps just, or powerful, or their protector, and now they're experiencing the very real reality of evil, injustice, and destruction. And there's a sense of abandonment. And so these people of faith, in no uncertain terms, are calling God out. Hey, what are you doing? What's going on? Where are you? Are you gonna show up? Now, I wanna clarify, because for some of us, we were taught that interacting with God this way at best was unseemly and at worst was unfaithful. But I wanna unequivocally, firmly state to you that that's ridiculous and actually kind of heretical, because the text is full, like chock full of people who were faithfully crying out in rage and hurt and despair toward God. And God not only allowed it, but often honored those people with a new vision of God that changes everything. So this is what Brueggemann will call reorientation. So we had orientation, disorientation, reorientation. And that's what we're gonna find in any good lament and in the text today. It looks something like this. I know you're a good God, but all I see is evil abounding and winning everywhere around me. So how dare you say you're good? I simply cannot see, understand, or believe such a thing. And then something mystical and miraculous happens, some event to the writer or the people where they're unable to see God anew. And that vision changes everything. God is not only good here, but good everywhere and always. And often the mystical bit is into the past and the present and the future, east to west, depths of hell, highest of heavens. It's mystical because so often they are experiencing a transformational awakening, an imaginary busting vision of God. That word imaginary is utilized from a philosopher, Chuck Taylor, who talks about our imaginations kind of like the lid for how far we can imagine something going. And sometimes what we need is our imaginary to be like the lid to get busted open. And that's often what's happening to these people who are lamenting. They can only see this, and then the lid gets busted open. It's a mystical experience. It's miraculous because even though often the realities are not changing, everything's still kind of terrible. Their despair evolves into a song of praise. And so it doesn't quite make sense for us. It's out of this world. So that's the structure we have here in Psalm 74. This is an idiomatic translation, which means that the text is back there, huh? Doo-dee-doo. No. Nope. I think it's only in there once, but that's okay. We'll go backwards. Everybody bear with me. Everybody bear with me. It's an idiomatic translation, which means I peeled through and walked through the Hebrew this week and made my own translation based on what translators wrote, but I'm just that picky about the Hebrew that that's what I did. So it might be a little bit different than your translation, but we'll walk through that. So it starts right in here. I think what's interesting about this psalm is they don't even have time to talk about the orientation. They're so mad, they just go straight for the disorientation. Why God? So the fact that they're doing this, though, helps us see there was some orientation because they're talking to God, right? And they'll highlight some of that some more, but I love that this guy's like, I don't got time for that. We're going right to the heart. Why God? Have you cast us off forever? Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? Remember your covenant. Hold on to that word. Remember, okay? We're going to talk about that a lot, but it's very important at the end for what we're going to share. Remember your covenant community of old, which you created, right? So there's lots of you pointing fingers happening here, which you redeemed to be the tribe or the branch growing out of your heritage. This Mount Zion, where you came to dwell, and that word dwell is significant because it meant you came to dwell in relationship. Not like you just came to conquer, but you came here specifically to be in relationship. This phrase, remember, is really common in the Old Testament and the covenantal language. God will often do things and say, like, put a bunch of stones here. Don't forget this thing that I'm doing. Remember. So in the covenant, God will ask them to remember God's goodness, God's steadfast love, the covenant, kindness, etc. And often then the people call out to God, God, you remember, you also remember the covenant. You remember the promises that you made to us. And so in the lament, it functions both as a plea and a prayer and a practice of faith. They're appealing to the covenant that they've tried faithfully to hold on to, and they long for God to meet them in the same act of remembering. So there's a synergy happening around this word remembering. We are remembering you and the covenant and the promises. Could you please remember also the covenant and the promises, kind of that action there. And then this is a great phrase. Lift up your feet. Get up. March over here with your power. It's like lift up your feet. Feet can also mean authority. So like bring your authority over here towards the never-ending destruction. Anybody feel that? Every time I think I catch my breath over the last year, there's another hit that comes. The never-ending destruction, and then this is powerful. The enemy has done everything evil in the sanctuary. It's never-ending. Now, I don't want to meditate too long on this, but you could probably come up with a list of five things that is the most evil things you could imagine. Now, imagine all five of those happening right here in the middle of the sanctuary. It's pretty bad. What they're saying is pretty awful. Everything ever evil has been done. And worse over, it's been done in the sanctuary. Roaring enemies in the middle of your meeting place have set up their banners, leaving their mark. So, you know, it'd kind of be like us coming in and somebody had broken out every stained glass window in here and hung up KKK flags. We'd probably be offended by that, right? That wouldn't feel great to try to come and worship in this space. We'd wonder if that's even possible. This is what they're saying. So this is a time most theologians and historians think where the Chaldeans came in and razed the city. They tore it to the ground, destroyed everything, and carried off most of the people into slavery. And they were refugees in a foreign land stuck there. So this is emotional language, but this is a terrifying, horrific time period in Israel. That's why it's a communal lament. Because they all were experiencing this devastation. So lift up your feet, come, these roaring enemies. Like men who come down with axes upon the thick woods. This is a great imagery. It's saying this monstrous power, it's like this abnormally giant man coming with men coming down with axes, and they hit at the center of the forest and just gobble it up. The whole forest is felled with one swing by this force. All at once, like lightning, they foolishly strike the sanctuary's intricate carved work. So this is the breath of the destruction, indiscriminately swinging and gobbling up natural resources, things we value, the beauty of the earth is destroyed. But then also with like laser-like lightning focus, they find the beauty and the intricate carved work of the sanctuary and they destroy it. And to add insult to injury, these are fools.
foolishly these people are doing this, right? I mean, it'd be bad enough if they were like smart and crafty and that's how they got away with it, but they're fools. Find yourself in the text right now, anybody? I think there's something powerful here. It kind of seems silly to mention intricate carved works. It's a weird little line, but I think it's important for us to remember the power of beauty and art and how every empire and every oppressor wants to destroy that. And something even more that we must hold on to is the beauty and the importance of art. And so they make a point to note that that's destroyed. The holy place has brutally had the arts destroyed, like lightning striking again and again. So some translations will say hammering away at the holy site, but it's like lightning coming down to it. They have set fire to your sanctuary, burnt it down to the earth. We have this phrase in English, scorched earth, right? They scorched the earth. That's what they're saying here. They've defiled the dwelling place of your name. So like, it can't get worse, pretty much. Except they said in their hearts all together, like we feel like we should unify around oppression. That feels like a great thing to unify around, and they did. They all got together and said, let's oppress. In unity, all together, let's oppress them. They have burned up all the meeting places of God upon the earth. So the sanctuary has been utterly destroyed, razed to the ground, burnt, even the earth is scorched. But then all the meeting places, so common in Jewish practice of faith, like, they'd have places where they would sit around and argue about the Torah and write the Midrash, and they'd have places like where they would celebrate the Festival of Booths. So some things happened in the sanctuary. That was the high holy place. But there would have been a lot of grounds where they met to celebrate and practice their faith. And all of those had been burnt to the ground. You get a lot of this metaphor language of like, there's nothing left, high to low, low to high, it's all been destroyed. And then we come to the last three verses are the kind of the last cries of the lament. There are no signs. So everything we know that is a sign for us has been destroyed. We no longer see, which I think is interesting here. Like, even if there were signs, we don't have eyes to see them. We're so devastated and heartbroken. Have you ever felt that way? Like, have you ever picked up the Bible when you've been like devastated and you're like, there ain't nothing in here for me. All, you know, 66 books, I can't find one single thing. This is not my book right now. Or heard people worshiping or praying and you're like, I got no eyes. That's what this lament is saying. Even if there was a sign, we couldn't see it. We're so devastated. There's no prophet. This, again, this very painful line. We heard just a couple of weeks ago about how Jerusalem loves to kill its prophets. So we know why there's no prophet, but they're also lamenting the fact that there's no prophet. Prophet's role was to speak from God to the people. The priest's role was to speak for the people to God. So we can't see you or hear you. You seem to be gone. There's no one who knows how long. Sometimes when we're devastated and in agony, if we know there's an end to it or where the end might be, it can help us endure it. The worst part of agony is when there seems to be no end, and that's what the author's saying. And so then he just asks, or she just asks, how long, O God, will the enemy taunt? Will the hateful despise your name for eternity? Why do you turn back your hand, even your right hand? So the author is doing this cool thing, and they're going to keep doing this, of stretching back our memory into something. When the Israelites were delivered from the oppressive regime and empire of Egypt, the language they utilized was you reached out with your right hand. So this language would have tickled their ears to go, oh yeah, this happened before where we were destroyed by an empire and oppressed and you reached out. Why aren't you doing that now? That same thing. And then it's like these next three bits of Hebrew are like really clipped. Like you get the sense of, they're not even fully finishing sentences. It's kind of like when you're crying and you start doing the thing or you're hiccuping. It's sort of like, I feel like the author has come to that point here where they say, be in our midst. There's some faith happening, even in the midst of like, we don't see, we have no prophets, but again, it's pulling us back to the beginning of this, that Mount Zion where you came to dwell, right? Be in our midst. Embrace. You embrace. But it doesn't even say us in the text. It's like they can't even get that out, right? But they're like, you're supposed, like, oppression and empires is the thing you destroy. Destroy them. Why are we being destroyed? Which I know sometimes that's hard for us when we read that in the text, but I think it's a very real prayer to pray when you see evil winning. Is like, wait a second, that's not how this is supposed to work. And that's what the author is saying. And so we come to the end of the complaint part of the lament. The case has been laid out. The lament is bitter, striking, heavy, and sorrowful. And yet the writer's not like graffitiing it on some wall or posting it on Twitter. They're crafting it into a communal prayer towards God. So there's some kind of like beautiful faith that they're having in the midst of this pain. It's a bold act of faith in the midst of unashamed despair. And like all great practitioners of faith, the lament is wrestling with what they know about God, orientation, and what they're experiencing, the disorientation. And now they've come to the end of the argument. There's kind of no more cries, just those hiccups between the sobs. And now we turn to reorientation. And the author says, yet. Such an important line, such a beautiful prayer I offer to you today. If you can't see and you have no prophets around and nothing's resonating, just pray yet, just that word, yet. And let the stokes, like the fire of your faith get stoked with some hope, yet. It's like the image I get is like they're running as far away as they can from God as fast as they can because they don't even want to believe in that God anymore, but they can't resist like one last look. And then God's like right there and has been there the whole time. And they're like, whoa, it's you. Yet God, my King, is from of old. I love this one tiny line packs like a million punches. First, the lament states this pause, this look towards God and says, oh yeah, my King, mine. So the wrestling was never meant I'm apart or fallen away from God. This was, is, and always will be my God, moreover my King. And though everything in the world seems nuts, and clearly there's some king, an empire wreaking utter destruction and oppression upon the people through the machinations of empire, there is another King. And that King is mine. There's this thing that happens with the prophets in the Old Testament where they're on the earth right in the midst of what is happening, and they are arguing with people and priests and leaders, and then all of a sudden they get lifted into a higher perspective and they're all of a sudden in the courts of Yahweh. It's mystical, but then they start saying, speaking from a different space, and we feel that same movement here. Oh yeah, there's somebody else, a king. From of old, an ancient king is at work, and that king is mine. That king is no ordinary king, that king's from of old, an ancient time. Like they're saying, before your reign, you pithy little man in a tiny age and a tiny kingdom on a tiny throne, there's this other king of old. Like before the earth was even formed, and indeed the writer's going to stretch us out even further back than Exodus and begin to stretch out our faith and our soul, reaching us all the way to the beginning of time and creation to remember this ancient king and how mighty and utterly unmatched the king is. The ancient line reminds me of when Christ speaks to his disciples and he says, oh, this joy I'm giving you, it's not from the world, and so the world actually can't take it away. This king is not from this world, so this world can't take away this reign and the kingdom that's been brought by this king. It has no power here. What a powerful thing to remember as a slave dragged away to a foreign country, that power has no power. This ancient king is not of this world, and no puny, pathetic, earthly king or regime or oppressive empire can take the reign away. Yet God, my King, is from of old, working salvation, literally the words Yeshua, the name that Jesus is given, working Yeshua, working salvation into the earth. Working is an active, I mean, get really dorky, just hold on, I promise I won't do it very much, but this is super dorky. Working is conjugated in an active verb in a way that means it is a present action repeated again and again. It conveys the idea of engaging in an activity and producing something through effort. Through continual effort, the king from of old is working that soil. In the Old Testament, it's frequently used to describe God's creative and redemptive acts, but it's also used for human action. We have a piece of this. This concept of working underscores the importance, not just of intentions, but tangible actions. That makes my soul happy. Tangible actions. In the Old Testament, God's actions are central to his revelation and interaction with humanity, and human actions are often depicted as a response. So we come back to that remember word. There's a synergy within this word working. There's a God working and a human working that's meant to happen in this synergistic fashion. This working is no mere scattering, but it's a labor. And I love this. It's into, that word into is like the innermost secretive parts. So some translations translate this, God is working salvation into the womb of the earth. That's a great translation. And then that stretches us forward to Jesus, right? Yeshua is being worked into the womb of the earth. It's beautiful. Now, this is important because this word earth is the exact same word that was utilized in 7 and in 8, where the author states that the sanctuary was scorched to the earth and that all the meeting places of God have been burnt upon the earth. But now we hear earth in a new way. The king from of old, before any scorching, beneath it, above it, and beyond it, is working the same earth within its inner core. Salvation has been sown, is sown, and will be sown. This word earth would itch the ears of any good Jew, any person of the book, because no less than 30 times is it used in Genesis 1 and 2. 30 times. So this is saying, remember, this king from of old is not like of old from last week or the vintage of the 90s. I love when people say, this is vintage and it's from the 90s. I'm like, oh God. I was born in 80. I'm like ancient now by their term. This is ancient, like when there was a void and a nothingness, God spoke and created the heavens and the earth. Same word. Earth, earth, earth. 30 times they would have known that story. And now this author is saying, come up from this moment, this single time, and look at all the history, the cosmic history of the entire universe. That's the God and the King that we serve. It's stretching us back to that nothingness and remembering that a word from God created all things, and that God never left, and that work of salvation never stopped, and that God continues to work the earth by sowing salvation, salvation, salvation. What a hope. And now it gets really weird, and I love it. By your might, you broke the sea. Again, these creation images of God separating earth and land, breaking it out. You shattered the heads of the dragon in the waters. Man, we just don't have, write some songs like this, Sam, about dragons. I want to sing some of those. You crushed the heads of the Leviathan in pieces, and you gave them as food to the people of the wilderness. So it's doing some fun things here. I love this. Sometimes people have read things like this in the Old Testament and thought, oh, those quaint little folk people who were fantastical and nonsensical, but we'll just read the gospel. But we have to understand here, this is actually really subversive language. When a person cannot say the thing outright, they say another thing. The word dragon conveys a sense of power and mystery, often symbolizing chaos and oppression to God's order. And so it will be used later. Author is stretching us out into the past, but it also stretches us towards the future. In Revelation, same word dragon will be used to define and say empire. So dragon, leviathan, monsters, a person who could chop a forest down with one swing, is this way of talking about how empire gobbles up and devalues all human life and all humanity. You can't be a slave in a foreign land and be like, God's gonna knock down the Chaldeans. You get killed. So you say dragon. And they say, what does dragon mean? We don't know. It means scary thing, monsters. Evil people, not you, you're cool. They're often again, Leviathan, same thing, is used to do that. And then look at this lovely line, and he gave them to the people of the wilderness as food. I love that. So people of the wilderness, again, would have stretched them back to Egypt, wandering in the wilderness, right? The disenfranchised, those who have nothing, you've not only destroyed this oppressive regime, but you've fed it to the people in the wilderness. You split open the life-giving spring of the Wadi, and the wadi, and you withered sprinkling waters. So again, we're just getting this like paradoxical giantness of the creator, cosmic God, who can make waters burst forth and dry them up. And then I love this line in verse 16. Yours is the day, also yours is the night. There's this expansive beauty here, this creation imagery pulling us into the beginning of time and the wide spectrum of God. It's also a pull towards the future. In Revelation, Christ's face will shine like the sun, and then this is super weird, but at the end of Revelation, it says we won't even need the sun anymore because God will be among us. Now, I know science, so I know that doesn't work, but that's what it says, and it's like this mystical, metaphorical language for how close and near God will be to us. I know that doesn't make sense, but that actually makes me feel excited about what's to come. There's something wonderful that's so big and so massive in God's redemption, we can't even conceptualize it. And the author's hinting at this. It's also helping us to see there's nothing God is not a part of. No day too hot, no night too long or dark to somehow be apart from this God. In fact, you created all day and all night, and you exist and are present in all of it. You have set the boundaries of the earth. You made summer and winter. Again, summer denoting harvest and the fullness, and winter, the scarcity and the harshness. Both belong to Creator King. God is working in and through both summer harvest and winter rest. So I want to zero in on that verse 12, where the lament turns to the vision of God, and what the heck can all of this dragon language and stuff mean for us? What does it mean that the Ancient One is working salvation into the earth? I love this idea that the working is this active, ongoing labor, and remembering that in the Old Testament, actions are central to God's revelation and interaction with humanity, and humans' response is central to the story. So what is our human response to such times? The empire is empiring, right? Haters gonna hate, empire gonna empire. I know that's really good English, but that is happening and will continue to happen from all sides. And I would sum that up as just dehumanizing everything and everyone in every way possible. That's the work of the empire. Indiscriminate, voracious destruction of all humanity in every way. So we come back to, this is my favorite theologian, hold on, you have to bear with me, because all right. Walter Brueggemann notes in the Old Testament that, like this one, this communal lament, we are all must be discerning the times and what to do. This is what Yahweh demands of us. This is how he illustrates that. He says, first, Yahweh is a key and decisive actor in the narrative. You are the king from of old, working the soil. God is not far apart from us in this story that we're reading. God is not far apart from us now. There is no doubt that this is a theological report in which Yahweh evokes and legitimates the alternative community of justice. Hallelujah. Amen to God. There is an alternative community of justice. That is the work that Yahweh has always been doing, is trying to raise up an alternative community of justice. Anybody like that? Right? Amen. Thank you. And equally at the same exact time, Yahweh is clear that this is not simply a religious account, but has to do with the decisive delegitimation of an oppressive, non-covenant regime. Yahweh is always lifting up an alternative community of justice and always saying the empire, the oppression is not the way of God and is always trying to work towards its crumbling. We can also say amen and hallelujah to that. That salvation worked in the soil makes even the biggest, longest, ugliest building of that oppression fall. It cracks the foundations of it. This is huge. This is not just some quaint ancient story or song. It is showing us the formation of an alternative community of justice, even in the midst of being dragged away as refugees and slaves. Every story and every act is an indictment upon empire and those that oppress. Have you been angry? Have you been wondering, where are you, God, in the middle of painful times? I would argue, my friend, it is not because you are seeing something that God is not. But the salvation that has been placed into the earth of your body is crying out for an alternative community of justice with God, not apart. What could that look like for us? While this narrative is rooted in a concrete memory, this happened to these people, it's also a shape and function are to serve as liturgical reiterations and reenactments. Those are big words, but this is like a holy way for us to engage in this work now. Each new generation, that's us, is inducted into the rage and resentment against totalitarianism and into hope and buoyancy towards an alternative social possibility. That sentence gives me life. We're meant to feel rage and resentment towards injustice. So if you have been angry, you're not crazy. You're not wrong. We feel what God does at the sight of injustice, and that is holy, holy, holy. You are with God in the utter agony and horror at the evil taking place. And yet, we're invited to move through the rage and resentment and into the hope and buoyancy of an alternative social possibility. What could that look like? Each new generation is taught to read social reality so that the justice question, what's that? That's the issue of social power, social good, and social access are made major community concerns of God and the people of God. They thus make the justice issue central to the narrative of God. These issues are not extrinsic or optional, but belong at the very core of the narrative. They belong in the center of the text. Yes, yes, this is the way forward. This is the way into the work of salvation. It is not apart from God, which we might feel at times, just like the person writing this lament. Are you seeing this, God? Are you aware? Do you care? And Yahweh's resounding answer is yes, yes, yes. Move through the rage and into the hope. What does that look like? I think the text points to, for you and me, we all have a piece of earth to work salvation into. We've all been given a role here. What could that look like? Well, that's the tricky part. The part that pushes me and breaks me, because if I'm honest about the darker side of me, I'm like, you wanna fight? Let's fight. So I'm like, you wanna fight fire with fire? I wanna protest, or I wanna break something. I'm mad, I'm furious at the ridiculous work of evil that makes my friends scared for their lives, that makes me sick with worry for the vulnerable, that makes me grieve and shake with utter uselessness as the death toll of children rises above 17,000. I am furious, and every day it just rises. And in the darker moments, my imagination of what work could look like is so inadequate and pitiful and small. And worst of all, it's fueled by the empire. I realize just how little I've bought into the hope of glory. Because after all, the hero of this story, the emblem, the mascot, is not some beefed up, gun-toting, arms-wielding thug. The mascot of this text is a lamb. And I hate to tell you guys, it's not even like a tough lamb. It's a lamb that's been slain. If it weren't so ridiculous, it would be pitiful, but it's like the mystery and the mystical. It's that reckoning realization for me where I turn towards reorientation. Because I realize I've not just bought into empire notions of striking back, I've fully converted to them. I don't just find the gospel quaint at times, I have like an internalized gospel phobia, and dare I even say hate. Because there's a part of me that would find it so satisfying to watch the empire burn, and oh, how badly do I want to be the one holding the torch. But it just goes to show my utter lack of imagination. My mind's bottomed out. I'm sick with suckling a steady stream of prophets, newscasters, who've colored my worldview and my imaginary of what redemption and salvation could look like. I'm geared for the win,
not for resurrection and redemption of the earth. But the text is inviting us into a better way, right into the messy dirt of it. In fact, it's not even tricky to find in the text. If you read the book of Matthew, you literally cannot turn a page without finding some reference to God working salvation into the earth. We listened to this, Pastor Molly, last week, right? The fig tree. Every page, there's a story about this. Even more, Paul writes to the Galatians on this idea of what sowing salvation in the earth might mean. To live Christ, to walk with the Spirit. It is subversive and wild, completely upside down of any empire or any oppressive regime. It's an utterly different rhythm that we've sort of watered down by calling the fruit of the Spirit. But I would put forth to you today that these descriptors could just be the perfect and exact definition of what it means to work salvation into the earth alongside God, that ancient king, as an alternative community of justice. I want to read from the message because I want to challenge these words to fall on your ears in a fresh way and maybe crack open your imagination like they do for mine. And just Eugene Peterson, I think, outdid himself in this translation. So I'm going to read it. You can read along, or you can even close your eyes and just take this in. But what happens when we live God's way? God brings gifts into our lives much the same way that fruit appears in an orchard. Well, wow, that sounds like God sowing salvation into the earth. Things like affection for others, exuberance about life, serenity. We develop a willingness to stick with things, a sense of compassion in the heart, and a basic conviction that a basic holiness permeates all things and all people. We find ourselves involved in loyal commitments, not needing to force our way in life. We are able to marshal and direct our energies wisely. It's a good palate cleanser, huh? I love this text, and I love the next line. Peterson says, legalism is helpless in bringing this about. It only gets in the way. Other translations I love, they say, against such things there is no law. And indeed, empire throughout its horrible history has tried. Like even in our country, they said, you can't love people who have different color skin, and that worked really well for them. And then they said, you can't love people and marry people of the same sex, and that worked really well for them. They found out against such things, you cannot write love, a law against love. It does not work. Cannot write a law against kindness. Because of all the powerful things empire can do, it cannot legislate that. It cannot legislate people being good. It cannot legislate people being generous. It can try. But it can't actually succeed at it. So against such things, there can be no law. I love that line. This is helpful for us, especially me, who wants to burn things down. Oh yeah, there's a different way. There's a thing you can do that no law can be written against because salvation acts are just that powerful. Among those who belong to Christ, everything connected with getting our own way and mindlessly responding to what everyone else calls necessity is killed off for good, crucified. I mean, if there's something that would describe my life in the last year or so, mindlessly responding would probably be it. And I'm exhausted. I want to live into a way of God that no law can be written against. That is actually working salvation. Maybe it's that forest I'm planting that I'll never see, like the poem we read. Since this is the kind of life we have chosen, life of the Spirit, here's the key. Let us make sure we don't just hold it as an idea in our heads or a sentiment in our hearts. That's the temptation. But work out its implications in every detail of our lives. Man, that sounds like sowing salvation into the earth. That means we don't compare ourselves with each other as if one of us were better and another worse. We have far more interesting things to do with our life. Each of us is an original. I think there's something really hopeful and buoyant about this alternative community of justice that doesn't lose its humanity in the face of inhumanity, but doubles down in it. Like, I'm gonna human even harder. I'm gonna be good even harder. I'm going to love. I'm going to be joyful in the face of hatred. I'm going to have a serenity that you didn't give me and you can't take away from me. I'm going to be good even in the face of really, really, really evil things. These are not softballs. These are the very things that destroy this. Can these things really stand up to the dehumanization we see going on? I don't know. There's a part of me that's like, probably not. That slain lamb stuff, that seems like not the way to win. But 2 months, 2 years, 9 months, and 26 days ago, I was in the doctor's office, and she reached over and took my hand and said, I'm really sorry, there's no heartbeat, your daughter's dead. And I felt like a bomb went off. I literally couldn't hear anything. She kept talking, and it was like, rah, rah. And the whole ground fell out beneath me. I somehow got home, drove from there. I, by the grace of God, I don't know how, I even could see the freeway. I remember I took off the garment I was wearing and threw it away because I never wanted to feel the amount of agony I was in the middle of. I crawled into bed and pulled the covers over my head and just fought off the urge to pray to die. And that night, while death had its hand around my throat, there was a knock on the door, and Mel, who I barely knew, and Heather, and Brent, and Molly were standing there. And they had gotten 40 paper lunch bags and put tea light candles in them and sat them on the edge of our front yard. And I looked out into the darkness and saw a light. And they said, we don't have to come in, we just want you to know that we love you. And we said, come in. I don't remember if you guys stayed for 2 minutes or 3 hours. Like, I have no concept of time in that space. But I remember my face being so swollen I could barely see, and I also wasn't wearing my glasses, so you guys were just blobs across the room from me, but they sat there in gentleness and goodness and kindness and peace exuding from them. And that hand around my neck got loose. Death did not get the last word. And I remember one second while we were talking, I thought, oh my God, we might live through this. With just a whisper that like ran past my brain and then kept going. And it didn't magically make anything happen. We've clawed our way out of grief for 2.5 years now. But every time it felt really dark, I would remember those candles. Can kindness really stand up to something as dehumanizing as death? I actually know that it can. I've lived it. Can goodness and gentleness live up and against an empire? I think it can. In fact, all the stories I've read in history of revolutions are not because somebody got a bigger Uzi. It's because people got really human, said, we're not doing this anymore. And they pressed into gentleness and goodness. And that doesn't mean we don't ever, I think the goodness of Jesus was flipping a table. That doesn't mean we don't ever act. But it is motivated by a hope and a buoyancy of being an alternative community of justice. So I told you to hold on to that word, remember. Because on that last night, when Jesus took the bread, you remember what word he said? He said, remember me. Remember how kind I was, that little kids wanted to hang out with me. Remember that. Remember how good I was, that I flipped tables. Remember how patient I was, telling stories over and over again. Remember how peaceful I was, that a woman at a well wanted to talk to me about salvation. I had that much peace. Remember how gentle I was, that I picked up a guy's ear and put it back on his head just a little while ago. Remember me and my body broken. That's the way the kingdom of Jesus. And then he picked up the cup and said, remember me. Do this in remembrance of me. A lamb that was slain is the thing that overcomes. The blood spilt out is the new covenant for you and for me. And so, God, we bless these elements. And as we take them in today, we pray to remember you and remember the way of Jesus. And we receive an invitation into hope and buoyancy. Move us through rage and resentment. Every time it comes up, Lord, which I believe it will, move us through it into remembrance of you, into tangible acts of salvation into the earth. We bless these elements, and I bless you as you receive them. Amen. Please remember that our table is an open table. You need not be a member of this church or any church to receive it. The helpers are coming now. They'll be standing here. We also have elements for those of you who need gluten-free. And the worship team will lead us as we receive.